Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's launch into our first medical breakthrough. I have quite a few interesting things to discuss today. For the first time, a man with type 1 diabetes is making his own insulin after going islet cell transplantation, and it's without any use of immunosuppression. This was made possible with the genetic modification of allogenic islet donor cells to avoid rejection. Allogenic means that they come from someone else, not from self. The donor cells were edited, essentially, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what they did, but essentially, this patient got these cells grown up in the lab and transplanted into his forearm. He didn't need any steroids. He didn't get any anti-inflammatory or immunosuppressive drugs after the transplant. And he was still free of a transplant rejection response at 12 weeks. During that time, his hemoglobin A1C fell approximately 42%, and his C-peptide measurements showed stable and glucose-responsive insulin secretion. So let me clarify. The cells that were transplanted into this guy's forearm were acting autonomously. They were responding to blood sugar levels, and they were releasing two molecules of insulin held together by a little linkage bracelet called C-peptide. Now, when I shoot insulin into a person's body, that's just the monomer. The C-peptide isn't there. And that's one of the ways that we diagnose type 1 diabetes is falling levels of C-peptide from what would be considered normal. The fact that these cells were allogenic is extremely important, and it opens up the pathway to actually having essentially diabetes cure pancreas cells sitting in a refrigerator somewhere, just ready to be ordered up. It's really, really astonishing. The transplant recipient was a 42-year-old man who'd had diabetes, type 1 diabetes, for 37 years. And he had a baseline hemoglobin A1C of 10.9 and no detectable C-peptide while he was getting a daily insulin dose of 32 units. So he's not insulin resistant, but he was also not in good control. We knew he had an autoimmune cause of his disease because of things that we could see, like antibodies against islet cells. Now, the cells themselves that were transplanted into him came from a 60-year-old donor who had a blood type O matched pancreas and a hemoglobin of 6. And these were gene edited to avoid the need for immune suppression. The people at Sana Biotechnology actually used the CRISPR genome editor to eliminate the proteins on the surface of the donated beta cells. Now, these are called major histocompatibility antigens, or HLA, and there's type 1 and type 2. And these are the things where if you're going to transplant a donor, you need a donor match, because if these don't match, the immune system goes postal and just starts shooting at the organ that you've just transplanted in or the cells that you've just transplanted in. But the immune system's not stupid. So if you actually have no HLA at all, no tissue recognition, then it's, who's this guy in disguise? And it attacks it. So the researchers further had to engineer the beta cells to produce a protein called CD47 that turns off immune system attacks. And this CD47 might be engineered as a microRNA and injected, it might be a way to actually treat autoimmune disease, but that's still a gleam in its science father's eye. Now, no insulin at all is death. I want to emphasize that. Some insulin is life. Now, in the case of this gentleman, he still has diabetes. He still has to take insulin. They transplanted about 7% of a curing dose. They didn't want to transplant more because they didn't know how a human body would react to this. This volunteer was the first person to be treated, and they weren't sure whether he would have an immune response or a rejected response. But he didn't require any of the usual immune-suppressing drugs. And that's great, because people who have to take those for an organ transplant are at increased risk for cancer and increased risk for infection. So this is just the first 6 months. The 3 months was the paper that was published. They issued a test, another release that isn't in a paper for the next 3 months, and the transplanted cells continue to function, and they haven't triggered an immune attack, but this hasn't gone to peer review, so it isn't published. The Dr. Carlson and colleagues will continue to monitor the patient for the next 15 years. That's due to the European Union regulations. Other people have received pancreatic islet cell transplants. The first of those happened about 3 years ago, and if you are a regular listener, you heard about it here. But because those cells still had major histocompatibility markers on them, the individuals who got them and were cured have to be on immunosuppression, which, while it's certainly not worse than the disease, is almost like creating a disease itself. There's a company called Vertex that's developed an experimental therapy with other stem cell-based transplantation approaches, but same problem. These stem cells are still differentiated into beta cells, so they still express an antigen that can cause a response. I just want to take a moment and emphasize to you the potential world-changing aspect of this report. By removing genes that produce the immune-activating proteins, both the class 1 and class 2 major histocompatibility antigens, this could be done for any organ. This could be done, potentially inserting genes like the C34, would make it possible to grow those organs, maybe even transplant them into, grow them in other animals. We're so close to this major thing. We had that pig, that transgenic pig transplant that happened recently, where the cells that were removed, basically what was removed from the pig genetically, were the things that would cause the immune reaction, the alpha-gal protein markers in the pig meat, which would have triggered a massive immune reaction, were removed. And it worked. That was a kidney. But nevertheless, any organ potentially could be evolved. In pigs, you doctor essentially the genes, remove their histocompatibility antigens, insert the gene that lets it make the C34 marker, and now you have, you know, non-antigenic pig kidneys, pig livers, pig pancreases, and, you know, these pancreatic cells don't have to be inserted in the abdomen. They can be, you could have your butt making insulin. The idea that you could make this be an off-the-shelf product with no need for tissue matching, no complex editing process, one size literally fits all, is, well, potentially just around the corner. Things are moving so fast, and we have, besides, you know, what's going on in digital tech, we have these amazing new tools, and you'll be hearing more about them a little bit later in the program. I'm going to pull out the soapbox for a minute. This happened today with a patient. I have permission to discuss it as long as I don't reveal any personal data. But a patient came to me that I saw maybe 3 or 4 years ago for a second opinion. She'd been to a rheumatologist who told her that her osteoporosis was severe, That was lie number one, that she needed injectable therapy, that she needed to use a extremely new, and in my opinion, not warranted drug, which is released only for severe cases of osteoporosis. And we're going to talk about that drug. But before we do that, I just want to get a little bit big picture here and talk about the biological double negative concept. And I first encountered this as an undergraduate at UCLA studying neuroscience. And a lot of what goes on the brain is stimulating an inhibitor, which would cause inhibition. So in other words, you stimulate a nerve cell that's job is to suppress another nerve cell, and you get that nerve cell to be suppressed. And now if you stimulate the inhibitor of the nerve cell that was stimulating the inhibitor of the other nerve cell, you've now gotten less activity. You have this sort of arm wrestling thing between the stimulators and the inhibitors, and there are multiple levels of this going on neurologically. So in one synapse, serotonin may be acting as a stimulator and then feeding back on itself and inhibiting its own release for a period of time before it can be released again from that synapse. And that's where we get all of this crazy variability and complexity, is these simple sort of inhibitory and positive feedback loop cycles, which are studied throughout the brain, but also when I studied biochemistry, it's like all over biochemistry, it's all over chemical reactions, endothermic, exothermic, the whole thing. So this medication is monoclonal antibody, which means it's an artificial antibody. And whenever you hear monoclonal antibody, I want you to take a deep breath and say, how long has it been out there and what do we know about it? Because they are sold as precision devices, but they have all kinds of knockdown other effects due to the complexity of the system. You can't just turn off one switch in the body without affecting a whole lot of things upstream and downstream. So the simplified thing on the patient information page, really simple, prevents and treats osteoporosis. It works by making your bones stronger and less likely to break. Okay, this drug, what does it actually do? Okay, it binds to something called sclerostin, which is a molecule that's made in bone. Sclerostin, and it keeps it from doing its job, which is to bind to a receptor on the osteoblasts, which are the bone-building cells, and essentially act as a brake on the osteoblasts. Now, you want your bones to grow back and heal, but then you want them to stop. And that's when the sclerostin comes in and says, okay, we've recreated the structure. If we keep growing, then we're a tumor. So please turn off and just go into low-level replacement mode out and get out of replication and amplification mode. Okay, fine. So now you're basically cutting the brake lines and getting a increase in osteoblasts that presumably will last as long as the monoclonal antibody lasts and until the body can basically make more sclerostin, which I don't know, and I'm sure they don't know either, whether that can be upregulated as a reaction to this over time, because it hasn't been around long enough. It has, however, been around long enough for the shoe to drop, so to speak. And when I talk about the shoe to drop with a new drug, these things get tested on maybe 4,000 people. And what we're mainly looking at is, will it kill them? Oh, no, good. Now that we know that that dose won't kill anybody, let's play around with lower doses and look for the effect that we're trying to get and see what the sweet spot is. What's the minimum dose that does the thing we need to do? And then that is the dose that the thing will be released as the dose. And then we can make dosage changes later. Maybe it turns out that left-handed Norwegians need a higher dose of this drug, and then we can, you know, put a caveat in the instruction saying, yeah, but for left-handed Norwegians, you want it 1.5 of the standard dose. I know I'm making up something that sounds really absurd, but there are real dangers from generalizing to a single population group of, say, oh, white males, for example, in the United States, and then assuming that's going to work for African grandmothers in Zimbabwe. It's a real stretch, and particularly when you cross the sexual lines because of the hormones, but also ancestral lines make a big difference. Anyway, in the groups that have gotten this drug, which were probably largely Caucasians because this thing is expensive, and it increases the risk of heart attack and stroke by about 15%. So that's a lot. And you would have to, if I asked you, okay, I want you to put on the one side of the scale a hip fracture that requires surgery, and on the other side of the scale, a heart attack that might kill you, and I want to say that this drug reduces your risk of cuts your risk of hip fracture in the next 5 years in half, but it increases your risk of dying of a heart attack by 15%, or having stroke also by 15%. So what are you going to take? You're going to take that risk to avoid the thing that isn't quite as bad. I mean, it isn't great to break your hip, but it's worse to have a heart attack. This is crazy. And in an extreme case where the person is so osteoporotic, where they stand up and just the pressure across their hip of standing up is going to cause a fracture, that's the person who should be on this until we know more and until we understand which people shouldn't be getting it because of this cardiovascular risk. And here's the thing. I went and did a FRAX score, and you can go and you can just search FRAX Sheffield and you'll get the risk calculator. I put the woman's numbers in, and her 10-year risk of all fractures was 10%, and her 10-year risk of a hip fracture was a little under 4%. She didn't have severe osteoporosis. She had mild to moderate osteoporosis, and she hadn't been offered any of the generic drugs, which, you know, the devil you know and all of that. So she hadn't been offered by this very sophisticated doctor a bisphosphonate. She hadn't been offered hormones. She hadn't been offered exercise, weight-bearing therapy, calcium, vitamin K, vitamin D, you know, the usual things that one would start with. No, they went straight to the very expensive, probably profitable for the institution, and substantially more dangerous drug. And the patient had no issues, actually, with the more conservative drugs and hadn't been tried on the simple stuff. So I'm just saying, strong medicine for bad disease, old-fashioned cheap medicine for old-fashioned average disease, or maybe some lifestyle changes. You aren't going to undo osteoporosis with lifestyle changes, but at her age, which was over 70, she probably would be able to stabilize further bone loss with lifestyle changes, and we can track that and pivot to drugs if need be. So all I'm saying is get a second opinion from a naturopath or a functional medicine doctor before going on one of these really new, really expensive, really profitable drugs, because I'm not sure exactly whose interest it's being recommended. And in this case, I'm really glad that woman came to see me, and we will monitor her and start with lifestyle and move to, like I said, lots of vitamin K, lots of vitamin D, moderate amount of calcium and magnesium, and lots of weight-bearing exercise. The astronauts, when they come back from space, have to do all of those things in order to get back their bones, but they do get back their bones. When you're older, you may not be able to get them back, but you can stabilize them. And if you stabilize it at 10%, 10-year risk of fracture, yeah, I'll take it. We've got a call coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and pick that call up. Hi, you're on the air. This is Dr. Dawn. What's your name?
Hi, my name's Lewis.
Hello, Lewis. What can I do for you today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I have recently broken out basically pimples. They are, they sting and they itch. And basically this has been confined so far to the upper part of my body. I go see an acupuncturist for my back, and I happen to mention this to my acupuncturist, and I showed him the sores. He said, oh, I'm seeing, you're not the only one. I'm seeing other people who have these. In fact, they have it much worse than you do. They break out in rashes that itch, and they ooze. So I'm calling because I was wondering if you have any experience with this, any information. And before you answer, I should tell you, the acupuncturist told me that he suspected the RNA vaccine for COVID. And he suggested I look up studies about this because it's been suppressed. Mm-hmm. And even he said the Mayo Clinic has done a study about this. People don't want to talk about it. And I was very surprised because, you know, when I got the shots, I thought, you know, anybody who talked about anti-vaccines was crazy. And I did start out with the Johnson & Johnson, which was a DNA. Then I got a booster a year later or so, which was a Pfizer RNA. So, again, I'm asking you what your opinion is about this. Have you seen anybody with these symptoms?
Okay. Yes, I've seen what you're describing. You know, obviously, dermatology over the radio is definitely a speculative act, okay? So I can't possibly make a diagnosis. I do want to put the vaccine issue to the side for a moment, quite honestly, because if you have a vaccine-related complication, which I'm not saying you do, but if you did, you would treat it in the ways that I'm going to be talking about, because it's not like you can go and suck the vaccine out if indeed that were the culprit. So let's respectfully acknowledge that it's not impossible to have a vaccine reaction, that it is a stereotypical pustular stingy thing. I would say there's an awful lot of other things that can do that. And one of the things that argues against a ingestion or a injection, and you know, is that if you inject something, it's going to go everywhere. If you eat it, it's going to get into your bloodstream and go everywhere, and you don't have the rash everywhere. So the first thing you do with a rash is you look at the distribution. You characterize the rash. It's pustular. It's got pus. It's vesicular. It's got clear fluid that gets crusty and leaves yellow, you know, kind of yellow crap on the skin around it. You know, those sorts of things. But then you say, okay, where is it? You said mostly your upper body. What about your face? Is it on your face?
No, it isn't.
Yeah?
My arms, basically, and my one on my chest and two on my back.
Okay. And so mostly on your arms?
Yeah.
Okay. And on the palms of your hands?
No.
Okay.
Upper arms.
Upper arms. I'm taking a moment to visualize that, and I'm thinking, well, one thing that will give you zits on your upper body, pimples effectively, is Pseudomonas rash, which is sometimes called hot tub folliculitis. An improperly cleaned hot tub or spa, swimming pools too, but it likes hot water. Those happen a lot, and they would be upper body. If it's mainly on your arms and it's summer, and maybe I start thinking, well, what about sunscreen? What about some topical preparation or a plant thing that's getting on the skin? Those rashes are typically rough and maybe blistery, but not pimply unless they're infected. But if they're bacterial, they're, you know, they definitely have a white pus on the inside. There's a whole lot of potentially infectious things or reactive sort of topical allergy things. I mean, if you've ever had poison oak or seen poison oak, it's where the poison oak touched and then wherever the poison oak stuff got smeared, and it's basically invisible bicycle grease. So it sticks when it smears, and as it thins out, you get less rash, but it seems like it's spreading from the original rash. It's not. It's just that that's the highest concentration area. So these things can be tricky. Now, I want to turn back. So I'm not going to be able to diagnose you. You know, I'm in clinical practice. I'm all chief of the family medicine department. And so I see a lot of cases. I hear things at the hospital. We don't have an epidemic of this. We don't have a lot of people showing up with some kind of stereotypically characteristic rash. We're seeing the usual rashes, but there's no big bump. Now, getting back to the RNA vaccine thing, you can't prove a negative. It's impossible to prove a negative. In terms of research, I will tell you, unless you are a scientifically qualified individual, you really are not able to interpret. You know, they say research it yourself. And the problem with that is you don't know how. And none of the people who do it and say, look what I found in my research, get a passing grade in a research science course. There's all kinds of details and things. And also, people can publish anything they want on the internet. So half of what the research turns up is going to be stuff that was published in a pay-per-published journal because it couldn't pass peer review. What I was just saying earlier, if you were listening, about the peer review thing where they released 6-month data, but it isn't published, so it hasn't been looked at, so they can't, all you can say is they released it and they said that, but you can't believe it because other people with no skin in the game haven't looked at the numbers and said, yeah, you did the math right. And that's a really basic part of science. And we threw peer review out for 2 years during COVID because peer review slows it down, and we had no idea. And we just put it out there. But the standards for stuff published between 2020 and 2023 were lowered. So there's a lot of misinformation out there in Lancet and other places that subsequently has not replicated. But it's there. And if you research it, it's, you know, the little puppy dog fetch mechanism of the internet is going to bring you all the stuff that reinforces the other stuff that reinforces the other stuff. But you don't really know if what's true and what's not true. In my opinion, this is what's going on with the vaccine. I will explain. This is based on my personal experience. I have not done science on this. I have read a lot of science on it, however, and good peer-reviewed stuff that has replicated, and I do believe, is true. So what I think happens with COVID-19, that little marker, right, that we're making the vaccine against, right, which is the thing that hooks onto your cell, that spike protein has to be activated by something on your cell surface that's around there to do something completely different, but the virus has learned how to exploit it. So first it lands on the cell and sticks. Then it gets activated by something that's on the surface of the cell. Then it's able to send the virus into the cell and hijack the factory and make millions of copies of itself until the cell literally bursts open and releases all of these copies of spike protein, which then go and infect other cells. So you have this geometric progression that's, you know, like a nuclear explosion where, you know, one thing hits another thing, and then it's, you know, they all start hitting each other, and you get this massive increase, amplification of the change. So that's how a virus works. Now, the RNA vaccines all create that amplification. They essentially infect some muscle cells in your arm with spike protein, and the body makes lots of spike protein locally, and that spike protein is not enough to make you sick like COVID sick, but it's enough to freak the immune system out and cause it to start making antibodies to the spike protein. But the thing that the spike protein is grabbing onto is an anti-inflammatory mechanism. When it grabs, gets on there, it breaks it. It breaks the anti-inflammatory. So you're going to have, well, think of it as fire-extinguishing foam. You have a certain supply of fire-extinguishing foam. Getting COVID for a long time wipes out a big portion of your supply. So now you get all these little brush fires that you can't extinguish in your body, and you get achy, or it happens in your skin, and you get skin dermatitis. In my case with the COVID vaccine, I got eczema. I don't get eczema. I'm, you know, in my 60s, and each time I got a vaccine, the spike protein particles in my antibodies, which were being stimulated to be made, and they were there, and they grabbed the spike protein, fed it back to the bone marrow, and said, yeah, that's still, this spike protein still comes around. I guess we better stay alive and continue to put out antibody. And so that feedback mechanism gives me immunity. But during the process of boosting the immunity, I get itchy skin. I get red spots. I get a rash. I throw some cortisone on it, and, you know, it goes away. It's like unpleasant. Everybody's got a story about how their arthritis kicked up, or their this, that, and the other thing kicked on. But it's almost like, it's like the vulnerability that they had before gets activated. Did you want to comment or ask further questions?
Yes, comment and one question. I wanted to thank you for clarifying that. And I would definitely, just like what you were talking about, a choice between the lesser of two evils, either a broken hip or a heart attack. In that sense, if this is the price I'm paying, if in fact it's related to the COVID vaccine, I would gladly do it again rather than have COVID.
Yeah,
but
because
my question is,
go.
Yeah, you mentioned during the COVID crisis that there wasn't time for enough peer review. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. So if there wasn't enough time, do you feel, everything else being equal with vaccines, do you feel that in the rush, they might have not found markers that would indicate some sort of really bad side effects to the vaccines? And the second part of my question is, do you think as far as I understand it, the DNA, like I had a Johnson & Johnson initially, the DNA being around longer and being, you know, tested on people longer was a better safe way to go than the RNA, which was brand new. And again, as far as I know, wasn't given the usual amount of time for testing on people. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, the RNA vaccine was 10 years old. It was,
okay.
It was not new technology. There was just no market for it.
Oh, and, I see. Okay,
and so,
I stand corrected.
And so it had been pretty well researched in animals and in humans, as far as that goes, but only in terms of injecting other forms of RNA vaccines, because, you know, making vaccines against something innocuous, in other words, but you could show the bump in the antibodies, and you could show, if I give you a vaccine against cobra venom that's an RNA vaccine, you will make antibodies against cobra venom, but they'll just float around and they won't get stimulated or boosted because you're not being bitten by cobras. So eventually they just fade away and go into the memory banks. And should you ever be bitten by a cobra in the future, you might survive it because if you have enough residual of those little antibodies floating around, it's like the cells that make the antibodies, every time you get exposed to it, they start dividing and they, for a long time, make more antibodies. They put out, you know, the same amount, but now they've tripled or doubled in the number of cells. So you get the idea, right? More factory workers turning out the same amount of stuff per hour means more stuff. That is very unlikely. My explanation of just taking out an important anti-inflammatory component, it rebuilds itself slowly. I mean, most of the people with long COVID recover, but it takes a long time. What's going on there? Well, until they rebuild all of their ACE2 receptors, that's what they're called, you're stuck with more inflammation at baseline. So it's like the difference between, well, here in Santa Cruz, we worry about fires a lot more in the summer because there's a lot of fuel out there. And you can think of inflammation as hot, dry summer weather of the body. And it just breeds more inflammation because it increases your vulnerability. And if there's something that's, you know, a little not quite right about your joints or not quite right about your autoimmune control, it's going to make it worse until you grow back that organ, that anti-inflammatory ACE2 receptor. And once that comes back and eventually they get replaced, then you're back to your baseline. And there are some individuals where it sets off something that just stays. And maybe they would have gotten set off by cancer chemotherapy or some other extreme body stress, but the COVID itself was enough. But we don't see long COVID from the vaccine. We see, you know, we just, there are no cases of long COVID from vaccine. There are cases of people who got vaccinated and then developed an autoimmune disease, and now they're tired because they have an autoimmune disease. But at the most, and this is stretching it, but, you know, I would be willing to say it, you know, it's kind of like that was ready to break and it was the first thing that hit it and it broke. But it would have broken eventually anyway because it was already dysfunctional, but it just hadn't been triggered. And so you can think of the vaccine as maybe possibly being a trigger in some people because, yeah, it caused inflammation and all it took was a, you know, could have happened with a case of pneumonia as well. All it took was some good strong inflammation that they couldn't turn off and the whole thing shifted and stayed shifted. You don't blame the trigger. You know, if the glass falls off the shelf because of the earthquake, or does it fall off the shelf because someone slammed a door? It's still broken, but it's the glass was too close to the edge of the shelf. It isn't that the door, you know, hated the glass, or that the door, it's a trigger, not a cause. Does that make sense? The underlying cause?
Very good. Yes. Thank you. That's a very illuminating analogy. I appreciate that. It makes a lot of sense. May I ask you just one more question on leaving?
Yeah, sure. You're asking really good questions.
Okay. Well, I'm glad because I wasn't asking just for myself. I know there's been a lot of controversy out there, and I thought, well, maybe other people may be experiencing this, and this information might help them also. But my question is, and you don't have to answer it on this show, maybe another show when you have time. As you know, RFK Jr. just put the kibosh on further vaccine research. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you what your opinion is in the long term about not having this kind of research for vaccines.
Okay. All right, this is going to be a somewhat nuanced response, but I have thought about this.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, very good. Bye-bye. All right, so let's start with talking about some of the things that are wrong with the system. I actually had this conversation today with a patient. If the government decides to pay for something, you are going to get a lot of it. And so, for example, when the government said, you know, we're going to provide incentives for renewable energy research. A whole bunch of money came out of private equity and said, oh, there's a guaranteed market here. We're going to invest in this guaranteed market and develop products that we will have a guaranteed purchaser for. This is how wars work. This is why ammunition and aerospace industries are so profitable, because they essentially are consumables. Airplanes and bombs are consumables. And when you have a war, the government's going to borrow money to buy more of them, even because it's sort of got to, right? So it's great, you know, if you've got a guaranteed market. And when we did the vaccines for children, we didn't want, it really was no child to be left behind. We did not want kids not to get necessary vaccinations. And this goes back, I don't know, 25 years more. I don't remember. I don't know the exact date. It's always been a part of my professional life, so I know it goes back before 1990. And we would, you know, essentially the government bought the vaccines and we gave them out. And we would get resupplied. We had to document what we'd given out, and then they would send us more free vaccine. And the idea was, you know, we want all of the kids to get vaccinated. So my job was to make sure everybody got tetanus shot, everybody got measles, everybody got diphtheria and polio and all of these really devastating diseases, right? So that was great, you know, and it was mainly polio, DPT, and MMR. Those were the big vaccines. Along in the early 90s, we came out with a vaccine against cervical cancer and oral cancer and pelvic cancers caused by HPV. And we've basically beaten cervical cancer at this point, 25 years later, it's receding like crazy in young women because they, before they have sex and are infected with the virus from a partner, they get this vaccine, and it's been transformational. So there are other diseases that, and we had hepatitis B. And for me, that was one was like, why are we vaccinating every infant for hepatitis B? And I never really liked that one because why? Well, what if their mother becomes a drug addict and gets hepatitis B and they'll be infected and they might get liver cancer when they're older? And okay, that's not always plausible, but I'll say, all right. But you really probably don't need to rush that vaccine at, you know, as a newborn. And do you? Well, maybe if you're a inner city public hospital, but, you know, out in the suburbs or in Beverly Hills. But, you know, it's one size fits all kind of thing. That's what public health does. So, yeah, as a doctor, I had some leeway, and I didn't give kids a lot of vaccines all at once, just because I thought it'll probably work better if we give them one at a time, because the immunes, they were only tested one at a time. And so we'll get an optimum immune response if we, you know, I've never seen real proof that giving them all at once like improves the result. And it certainly is kind of devastating, but one shot's not that big a deal. And most kids will not get, you know, terribly phobic. It's just become, oh God, I'm going to get a shot. I'm going to get a treat. And, but you know, three or four needles coming at you when you're little is just too much. So I tried to, you know, do it every 2 weeks, and I was fortunate in that I had a community where I could make that work, and I could track it, and people got their shots. And then more and more vaccines started rolling out because, hey, guaranteed government market, right? We don't have to argue with the insurance companies. The government's paying for it. The government has unlimited pockets, so to speak. And so it was a way for companies to print money. And a whole bunch of, you know, not really all that important vaccines came out. I mean, the latest one with the RSV is, that's actually a good vaccine. But the rotavirus, you know, that's a case of diarrhea. And the first vaccine that they came out with for rotavirus and released actually caused a complication, a gastroenterologic complication that led to hospitalizations and surgery. So they pulled that one. And eventually they found another one that didn't do that. But my point is we are over-vaccinating in terms of the number of diseases that we're targeting. And they're a lot of them in healthy children, not really that necessary. But if they help kids who are compromised, immunocompromised, or sick, or have other cardiac or other issues where they're vulnerable, you'd like to have those vaccines. But the only way you can get the company to make them is to have a big market and buy them for everybody. So it's a real catch-22. We don't subsidize vaccine development in a way that doesn't create this perverse incentive to build more vaccines than we realistically need if we were being parsimonious. So there's that. And then there's just the fear and distaste for having something foreign and, you know, debatably dirty put into your body in order to help you fight off dirt in the future. I really appreciate the immune system, but even I, you know, have just a moment of kind of like, okay, I'm going to go home and take a hot bath and with Epsom salts and sweat so that I don't end up with a lot of achiness from all the other stuff they put in the vaccines to make sure that the immune system gets sufficiently irritated that it goes after the substance that's been injected. And I think that the adjuvants that are added, particularly in the case of Shingrix, are too strong. But the company got the drug approved by having to show a robust antibody increase. And the way to do that is to annoy the heck out of the immune system. But when the immune system is annoyed artificially, chemically, or by a disease, you feel really crappy and tired and achy and maybe foggy mentally. and that lasts for a couple of days. And some of my older patients, that Shingrix vaccine put them down for a week. And all for the very laudable case of preventing chickenpox, or excuse me, preventing shingles. But really, we have drugs for shingles that work pretty well. It never kills anybody, although it can make people miserable. But the you know, commercial scare tactic advertising that was used to promote Shingrix overstates the frequency of shingles. It's a blatant overstatement. I don't know where they get that number, but I'm sure they found a paper somewhere that they could interpret that way. So a very long answer to a really complex situation. And I have no answer. I have only a response and some opinions. Something short and interesting. I like this one. You know, when you think about medical robots, you think about like something with arms and legs. But what about a robot mattress that prevents pressure ulcers in people who are paralyzed and can't turn themselves? So pressure ulcers are a common and rather devastating ailment in patients with limited mobility. And you could also do a robot cushion for a wheelchair, which would also help. Once you get that broken down skin, it's very hard to heal if you're lying on it or sitting on it. And sometimes people are forced into very uncomfortable positions to get the weight off of the area that needs not to be squeezed. So this was published in Robot, I guess they have a subdivision, but the Science Journal cohort of journals has one that's all about robots. So here's a robot bed, and it has 1,260 little pistons in it that are independently controlled. And so what they do is they got this anatomically correct dummy, and that I guess had sensors in the skin so they could measure the pressure and the pattern of the pressure, and they undulated it in checkerboard patterns. So they had, like, imagine a bunch of pistons and half of them are up and half of them are down at any given moment over, and let's see, this is a bed, so 12 by 60. So you've got like maybe 100 pistons, let's call it 60 or 70 pistons. I didn't do the math ahead of time. And so, but it's a lot. And each one of those is coming up and supporting your weight, kind of bed of nail style, and then dropping down. And another one next door is coming up and supporting your weight. And that's what it's doing. And they actually found that the best way to prevent pressure ulcers was actually, it's paradoxical, but it was to press really hard briefly and then let up on the pressure. And that kind of creates kind of a pumping massage action that actually stimulates blood flow to the area. And so now they're going to design a mattress that will do that a lot more smoothly. So it'll be like you're, you know, literally floating in water. And the area of occlusion was shown to be 34 times smaller than what you get from a standard foam pad. So this should reduce bed sores in patients very effectively. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.